This is a Triple J podcast.
Hack. Hey, it's Dave Marchese. This is the Hack Podcast. Is there a place for single-sex schools in modern Australia? Should we be making them co-ed? There's been a lot of talk about this recently. Traditional boys' schools moving towards letting girls in, parents not happy, teachers weighing in, experts as well. What do students think, though? Because we're going to be asking students who've recently been through this, the switch from single-sex to co-ed, what it was like later in this podcast. And we're going to hear a whole bunch of experiences, talk to an expert as well to tell us what the research says. Later, we're going to explain what the decision by Meta to end its pay deal for Australian news content actually means. Is it going to have an impact on you? First, though.
Hack.
A man has been charged with the murder of missing Ballarat woman Samantha Murphy.
On Triple J.
Yeah, today, a development in a story that's rocked the whole country. The disappearance of Victorian woman Samantha Murphy. She went missing more than a month ago after waking up and going for a morning run in Ballarat, and a massive investigation is underway. Today, police announced a man has been charged with her murder.
We will be alleging that murder occurred at Mount Clear on the day she disappeared. In the interview with the suspect, he has not disclosed to police where Samantha's body is.
So what more do we know? Laura Mayers is a reporter with ABC Ballarat and she's been following this story. G'day, Laura. Thanks for coming on Hack. What have police announced today?
So police have announced today that 22-year-old Scotsburn man has been charged with just that one single count of murder. That man, who cannot be named for legal reasons, is accused of murdering Samantha Murphy in Mount Clear on the day she disappeared. That is Sunday, the 4th of February. So missing persons squad arrested the man at his home address in Scotsburn on Wednesday morning. He was interviewed over a number of hours and a number of search warrants were executed by police. And as you heard earlier, police have confirmed that he has not divulged where Samantha Murphy's body is in those interviews. Chief Commissioner Shane Patton said today, just to reiterate really, that Samantha's family has today been made aware of this tragic update, as he said, and just due to the intense amount of scrutiny he really praised to them, just confirmed that there's no involvement whatsoever of Samantha Murphy's family in this matter.
Has the accused faced court today?
He has. I just popped out of court now. I was there this afternoon in court today. An interim Australia-wide suppression order was put in place by his lawyer that prevents us from naming him or giving certain further details. So the man's lawyer cited concerns of prejudice for any potential future juries. So he appeared today, the 22-year-old, in court from the dock, and he was wearing what appeared to be a tradies uniform, so orange and navy sort of outfit. He seemed calm. He was looking straight ahead during the proceedings. We heard today that this was the man's first time in custody. He did not have a history of poor mental health or drug abuse. So police prosecutors have asked in court today for a significant amount of time to go through all the information they have. As we've been hearing over the past month and a little bit, this has been a lengthy and protracted investigation. So the 22-year-old was ultimately, of course, remanded today in police custody.
So what happens now, Laura?
So there will be future court dates. Next one is in April, and that's just to undertake sort of administrative proceedings as the case progresses. And then we're expecting for there to be a committal hearing for the 22-year-old. That's not until August, some sort of 6 months from now. So to be very clear, this is expected to be a lengthy court process.
Laura, I mean, the disappearance of Samantha Murphy's obviously been making headlines right across the country. There's been so much interest in it. What's it been like in the Ballarat community specifically? I mean, you live and work there.
I do. One thing I've really noticed today after the news was revealed that this 22-year-old Scotsburn man was charged across social media today, you know, you can see just how much it's been impacting locals. We heard earlier this month that across schools across Ballarat, they had been offering sort of support services. We've been hearing that a lot of children had been really anxious by the news. So people are understandably horrified. And as I said, more details will emerge as the court process continues. And, you know, my heart just goes out to her family today.
As you say, we will be hearing a lot more about this case. We appreciate your update. Laura Mayers from ABC Ballarat, thank you very much for joining us on Hack.
Thank you.
Hack.
We can talk about targets and numbers, but at the end of the day, they're real people.
On Triple J.
You would have heard closing the gap before, even if just here on Hack. It's the term used to describe the inequality between First Nations people and the rest of the population, and specific areas like education, health, security, employment, housing and life expectancy are compared and updated every year. And countless politicians over the years have promised to close the gap in the decades ahead. The latest update has been released, and it's found only 5 out of 19 targets are on track, and some of the targets are actually getting worse. Ariana Lucente's been looking into it.
For 16 years, the Australian government's been releasing data on how it's going against the Closing the Gap targets. And now we've got the 2024 report card. It's not a good picture. It shows only 5 out of 19 targets are on track.
The disappointing thing is that there are targets that are still going backwards.
Now, the gap here refers to the health and life expectancy differences between First Nations peoples and the non-Indigenous population in Australia. And in some cases, the gap is huge. Catherine Little is the CEO of a group that lobbies for the rights of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children, called SNAKE.
It shows the stark reality of decades of government failure.
The news isn't entirely bad. The proportion of First Nations babies born at a healthy weight has improved, and the target of a 15% increase in land and sea country covered by Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples' legal rights is also on track. But some targets are actually getting worse.
By far, the majority of children removed from any cohort in Australia are Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children, and it continues to move.
The number of First Nations children in out-of-home care is growing, along with a gap in life expectancy. And there's some pretty grim figures on incarceration rates and suicide, which are also going backwards.
Aboriginal people are being arrested more frequently. We're not talking about offences such as murder. We're talking about petty offending.
Narita Waite is a Yorta Yorta and Narangiri woman and the CEO of the Victorian Aboriginal Legal Service. She's also a member of Victoria's First Peoples Assembly, the state's elected advisory body.
Overrepresentation is bound up in structural racism over racism. There's no adequate resourcing of things like housing, things like economic empowerment, things like education. All of the things that lift you out of cycles of dispossession and trauma aren't resourced.
Cherie Lowe is from the Victorian Aboriginal Community Controlled Health Organisation, or VACHO. She's a Chop Warong and Gundi Jamara woman and leads the Bullet Dern Dern Centre for Social and Emotional Wellbeing. She says the statistics on suicide are devastating.
For us as Aboriginal people, they're our community members, they're our family members, and the ripple effect of suicide within our community is far-reached, so it's not just a number.
Cherie says the mental health system in Australia doesn't always work for Indigenous communities.
We've had here in Victoria an increase in Aboriginal suicides. We live in a society now where there are a lot more life stresses, a lot more pressure, but also a service system that doesn't meet the needs of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people.
So what would work better?
Government don't know the answers for what will work within our communities, but they've been sitting at the table for a really long time with our communities. And so I guess I urge people in roles within government to truly sit and listen.
And Narita Waite thinks new treaties between First Nations groups and state, territory and federal governments would be another good step.
Treaty not only allows the handover of authority and resources to communities so they can pursue self-determined models that actually reduce overrepresentation and ensure that we're not just surviving, we're thriving for generations to come.
Hack on Triple J.
Ariana Lucente with that update. Some messages coming through. Imogen says, there's a lot of talk but not a lot of action from governments when it comes to actually working on and committing to closing the gap in Australia. Just a reminder as well, if you or someone you know, you're feeling worried or this has raised some issues for you, you can always connect with 13YARN, so that's 139276, to talk with an Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander crisis supporter, 24 hours, 7 days a week. And remember, there's also Lifeline, 13 11 14 as well.
Hack, there's not really any male or female-only environments left except prisons.
On Triple J.
Yeah, what do you think about turning single-sex schools co-ed? Because it is happening across the country. Schools that have traditionally been all boys or all girls are switching things up. Now, some are all for this move. They say it's about moving with the times. Others, though, say it runs the risk of disrupting students for nothing. What do you think? Have you had experience of this, of switching to co-ed from a single-sex school? I'd love to hear from you. How was it? Would you recommend it? Message in 0439 757 555. In a bit, we'll find out what the research actually tells us about this. But first, Ellie Grounds has been looking into it.
I'm an old boy of the school, and my son is also an old boy. And the intention was always that I'd have a grandson. But I won't bring him to a co-ed school.
You might have seen this clip a couple months ago. A small group of parents at Newington College, a boys' school in Sydney, protesting about the decision to admit girls from 2026. It's just one of a bunch of schools that are planning to switch from single-sex to co-ed. So what's it like to be at a school when a change like that happens?
It's the students who will be going to these schools every day.
Audrey Smart started high school at a girls' school in Melbourne, but then halfway through year eight, the school announced it would close at the end of the following year. Eventually, it was announced that the girls would be offered places at the boys' school across the road, which was going to rebrand and essentially become a new co-ed school, St Mary's College, St Kilda.
Going into year 10, we had about 15 girls going into a cohort of about 85 males. For that first day, week, first month, probably as far as the first year, I think it definitely felt like a boys' school with girls in it.
Audrey says it was a huge change.
The boys, you know, can be quite loud. There can be in classrooms a culture of whoever is the loudest will be presumed to be right and will be listened to the most. Same with roughness. Like, I think I got kind of bumped into and accidentally pushed around in hallways more in that first month than I had in my entire life up until that point.
But by the time Audrey had finished school at the end of last year, she says it had totally transformed.
That was probably one of the highlights of my time at high school, was getting to witness firsthand the kind of values and culture of the school shift away from that typical quite larrikinish, very, very masculine boys' school culture and values to getting to be very well-balanced co-ed environment that kind of uplifts people and encourages people.
Audrey was school captain last year alongside someone from the old boys' school, Raj Johnston.
Was there any overt sexism that you were aware of at all once the girls had joined the school?
There's instances, older students make silly comments and throwaway lines, and which is completely unacceptable, of course. I know the school was proactive in trying to stamp that out.
He admits that co-ed isn't for everyone.
A couple of girls did leave after the first year in our year level.
But like Audrey, Raj thinks it was ultimately a good move.
Of course, you know, being in a co-ed school, it really does replicate what the real world looks like. We work with both genders work together. There's no avoiding that.
St Mary's Deputy Principal, Sean Lancashire, reckons it's been successful because they did serious work with girls, boys and teachers on making it a safe co-ed school.
So we really focused on language. It'd be wrong to say they needed to learn sort of appropriate ways of interacting with the girls, because the vast majority of them were having a great time and were so pleased. But there were some sort of situations where some language was used and a lack of understanding as to what that language meant, and therefore that became focus number one for us early days.
They changed the curriculum a bit to give girls their own PE classes and changed which books everyone read for English. And they gave students a voice and tried to listen to them.
Once the girls were in the school and we were a co-ed school, and we were able to utilise student voice in creating with them what they viewed as being, you know, what the issues were or what they thought would be the right thing to focus on. And they were very good and very upfront and very keen to ensure that we didn't marginalise the boys in trying to promote their needs. So they were good in that. And many, many boys got involved in that conversation and parents as well.
Of course, this is only one school and two students' experience of it. I've heard from current and former Newington students, some who are for the change and some who are against it. Raj and Audrey both agree parents should have choice of where to send their kids, but think some of the parents at Newington are going a bit too far.
They're upset. Would I have felt that same reaction? No. I think the co-ed environment brings so many academic and social benefits you can carry with you throughout your life. So I just think it's a backward response, really.
To say that it's sort of just woke lefty kind of hippie stuff to acknowledge that that environment becomes more well-balanced is to ignore that it's mirroring what the rest of the world will look like for these young people, which is ultimately the purpose of going to high school.
This is Hack on Triple J.
Ellie Grounds with that story, getting a lot of messages on this one, on the text line, people with experiences themselves. Eva from Melbourne says, I went to both a co-ed and single-sex high school, and the single-sex high school experience was the worst time of my life. Someone else, I'm a female teacher in my 20s and refuse to teach at single-sex schools. And another person says, I'm training to be a teacher and I've worked in both girls' schools, boys' schools and co-ed schools. I think single-sex still has a place in our society purely because the way some schools teach is more geared to certain genders. But for single-sex schools to continue to remain relevant, they need to engage more with schools of the opposite gender. Right, well, let's unpack this all a little bit more with someone who's been looking into it. Dr. Claire Charles is a senior lecturer in education at Deakin Uni, and she's with us now. Hey, Dr. Charles, thank you very much for coming on Hack.
Hi, Dave. Thank you very much for having me on your show. Yeah, well, it's great to be here.
Well, and a lot of debate, right? People want to talk about this. There's a heap of discussion going on about them around co-ed schools at the moment and single-sex schools switching to co-ed. Is that because there is a big push to switch up single-sex schools right now, or is it something that's always been happening?
Yeah, that's a really, really good question. I think there's certainly a history of single-sex schools switching to co-ed. So in that sense, it's not new, but I think there's definitely a reinvigoration around it at the moment. And that's partly to do with some of the cultural issues that, you know, the people would be familiar with that are often featured in the media around single-sex schooling. So I think that's causing a reinvigoration of, interest in the issue. Because I suppose we have a broader reinvigoration to in our culture at the moment around sort of issues to do with gender, you know, gendered violence, all of the feminism, all those sorts of issues are, in the wake of the Me Too movement and things like that kind of, being taken up more broadly in the broader culture. So it kind of makes sense that there might be some interest around schools in these kinds of things as well.
It's definitely being debated a lot. And it's not just in one state or territory, it's right across the country. I want to ask you about what the research tells us, because we've got a message here, Dr. Claire, from someone who says some studies show girls perform better in single-sex schools while boys perform better in co-ed schools. I agree with this. That is something we always hear when this discussion is being had. Has there been a lot of research into this, and is that what it's found?
There has been a lot of research, and basically... The research is sort of inconclusive and highly equivocal. So there's really very little research evidence that single gender schooling is educationally advantageous for either boys or girls. Now, that said, if you want to go out and find studies that show that it is, you know, you will be able to find them. But if you kind of look at some of the more meta analyses, you know, that have been done, that have been trying to look at, you know, overall, what is the research actually telling us? So kind of meta analyses, you know, what they tend to find is that there really is no, solid evidence that of any kind of educational advantage of single sex schooling. And that's because the reason for that really is because gender is always more than just about gender. And so, you know, school cultures, what makes a school culture have good outcomes for particular students, you know, whether they're boys or girls, is profoundly influenced by other factors, and in particular socioeconomic sort of profile of the school, but also the cultural mix and even other really, really nuanced factors around the particular teachers or school leadership. So what actually makes a school work? What makes good educational outcomes for young people? Really can't be isolated to gender as the most significant factor. And so that's why often these myths, as you say, these sorts of ideas do continue to circulate and be quite powerful, particularly the idea that, yeah, girls do better in single sex. And if you look up, you know, any kind of girls' school online, you'll probably find there's comments there around that research evidence supports that. And certainly you can find if you're looking for it. It's but there. Overall, the general consensus among sort of experts is that there really is no strong research evidence of any educational advantage.
This is so sometimes. Oh, sorry, Dr. Claire. Sorry for butting in. You're listening to Hack. I'm Dave Marchese. I'm speaking with Dr. Claire Charles, a senior lecturer in education at Deakin Uni, and we're having a chat about single-sex schools turning co-ed. Big debate happening right around the country in different communities. This is going on. A lot of messages coming through on this one. Someone says, the all-girls school I went to is changing to parallel learning now, where boys and girls can both attend. Some classes are separated, but lunch and some other classes are mixed. I think that's a really good idea, and I wish it was like this when I was at school. Another person says, I'm a teacher at an old boys' school. If I had a son, he would not go to one. That's someone's opinion there. And another person says, I can see the benefits of elite boys' schools becoming co-ed to dismantle the boy club culture, but I can't see the issues with just girls' schools. Dr. Claire, I guess that is a point that people bring up as well. Are some of these switches perhaps happening, is it sometimes for the wrong reason that going co-ed is seen as a fix for some of the cultural issues that might be in place at all boys' schools, for example?
Yeah, definitely. I think that's definitely something that needs to be thought about, because there might be, one of the main reasons I think that the schools might make these decisions, I think we need to be clear that, you know, we do live in a country where education, it is a marketplace, right? So they have to kind of, part of what they'd be doing when they're thinking about making these decisions is thinking about their market share. And so if you open up your cohort to include the other gender, then you're going to be able to boost your numbers and your market share, and those are the sorts of things that kind of would be coming into play. And there is also the reason that, as you say, around perhaps cultural change and perhaps the recognition that certainly some of these elite boys schools, if we take those schools as an example, so the really elite ones that among the most wealthy schools in the country, single gender boys schools, I think there is recognition, and you certainly see that in the reasons that they give about why they're making the decision to go co-ed. There does appear to be, you know, recognition that perhaps their cultures historically are perhaps just not fit for purpose in 21st century life when we do have different expectations, because their cultures historically are very much associated with a kind of hard, sporty masculinity. You know, rugby or AFL and rowing are actually still the two sports at the kind of the top of the hierarchy in these schools.
Yeah, well, look, you know, things changing, as you say, definitely getting a lot of people talking this discussion. We appreciate your take on it. Dr. Claire Charles from Deakin Uni, thank you very much for joining us on Hack.
You're welcome.
And we got still a lot of messages coming through. Someone says, non-binary people exist too. There's way more than two genders. First, get rid of single-sex schools, then break down the gender binary.
Hack.
They're a $1 trillion organisation, for goodness sake, and they cannot pay just for simple news services.
On Triple J.
How much of your news do you get from social media? I'm really interested to know what your main source of news is. Is it TikTok? Is it Instagram? Is it Triple J News? What is it? Because would you find it weird if you were on social media and news was just eliminated from your feed altogether? I'm not saying that's going to happen, but something big has been announced in the past week. Meta, which owns Facebook and Instagram, has ended its funding arrangements with Australian media companies because they say nobody reads the news on social media. Do you agree with it? Message in 0439757555. Shalala Madora has been looking into it.
It's a sunny day at Launceston Mall and the buskers are singing their hearts out. But most people around here are glued to their phones and they're not reading the news.
I reckon Instagram is generally my main source, and I find myself, like, when I'm going to that doom scroll on Instagram anyway, like, it just happens to be there.
Oh, TikTok.
I don't really get any news. I talk to people, I hear about a couple of things.
I actually don't watch the news at all, which is probably really bad because I, you know, don't miss out on everything, but that's okay.
According to Meta, the company that owns Facebook and Instagram, that's not a one-off. It says people aren't going to its platforms for news. And because of that, it's announced it's pulling out of a multi-million dollar deal to give money to Australian news outlets.
We will not enter into new commercial deals for traditional news content in these countries and will not offer new Facebook products specifically for news publishers.
A bit of background here. For the last 3 years, Meta has been paying Australian news outlets, including us, the ABC, to put their content on its platforms.
Well, Australians who read a news article and want to share it on their Facebook page can no longer do so.
Back in February 2021, Facebook banned news from its platform in Australia altogether.
But those Australian users woke up on Thursday with no access to news on their Facebook feeds.
That was in response to a new law being proposed by the Morrison government called the Media Bargaining Code that would force social media platforms to pay for displaying news content. After a few days of this, the government reached a compromise with Facebook. The company wouldn't have to pay under the code if it made its own deals with news outlets. Those deals, reportedly worth around $70 million, were due to expire in the next few months. On Friday, Meta pulled the pin entirely, prompting outrage from Anthony Albanese.
Journalists need to be paid for the work that they do. And some multinational company just being able to get that free ride off the back of the hard work of news organisations here in Australia is not on.
Queensland Premier Stephen Miles said the move proved Meta isn't concerned about content.
Look, I think those social media companies are out of control. And I think it's about time we had a really good look at the power of these social media companies, how much money they're making here, and how little they care about Australians.
And here's the thing. While Facebook says people aren't engaging with news on its platforms, we just don't know why that is, as ABC journo Patricia Karvelis points out.
Their algorithm is completely opaque. There is no way of us knowing whether it's a supply and demand issue or whether they are actually deprioritising news.
The end of the deal is particularly bad for regional journalism. Tony Kendall from Australian Community Media, which runs a bunch of newspapers and websites outside the capital cities, says it could mean the closure of local papers.
It's disappointing, and, you know, we need either support from the people that have taken the money away from us, like the Facebooks and the Googles of this world, or a different model of support from the government to maintain public interest journalism in the regions.
So what happens now?
And the government can huff and puff all it likes, but the question is, will the government make Meta pay? If Meta doesn't pay, that is a hammer blow for Australian journalism, and there is no question that it will lead to very substantial job losses.
That's Shadow Communications Minister David Coleman talking to Sky News. He explains that under the media code, the government can designate companies like Facebook. In other words, they can force them into mediation to create new commercial deals.
Is Anthony Albanese strong enough? Because he's basically here effectively going to be in a negotiation with a company that's worth about $2 trillion.
Former head of the Australian competition watchdog, Rod Sims, says going down the designation route comes with its own risks.
Facebook could do what they've done in Canada. They're showing no news whatsoever. So if you did post a link to a friend of yours, that couldn't show up because they're only caught by the legislation if there's news on their platform.
Hack on Triple J.
Shalala Madora with that update. April McLennan helped out as well. A lot of messages on this one. Someone says, I get most of my news from Instagram through following news outlets. Another person, as a 17-year-old, there's no way I'm watching the news. I get it off TikTok or listening to Triple J. A lot of messages still coming through on the co-ed school story we did as well. Riley says, my friend went to an all-girls high school and told me that she's never experienced a more toxic environment when it comes to socially interacting. And Amy on Gadigal Country says, in my experience, the primary benefit of co-ed schooling is that students are less likely to start thinking people of different genders are completely different species. The transition period is rough, though. That is all we've got time for on the Hack Podcast for now. Shake up tomorrow. I'll catch you then. See ya. Hack.